resume with Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and State of New Jersey versus President of the United States.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Eric MacArthur for the federal government. I will be splitting my time 15 minutes each with Mr. Rienzi for the Little Sisters, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Granted.
In 2018, the departments decided to put years of contentious litigation over the contraceptive mandate behind them by expanding the pre-existing religious exemption for employers who have religious objections to the mandate, as well as by creating a new exemption for employers who have moral objections to the mandate. In Little Sisters, an earlier appeal in this very case, the Supreme Court held that both exemptions were within the department's statutory authority under the Affordable Care Act, concluding that the act gave the departments not only the authority, but what the court characterized as the virtually unbridled discretion to adopt these exemptions. On remand, the district court again found that the rules were unlawful, this time on the ground that they were purportedly arbitrary and capricious under the APA. And the court gave 7 distinct reasons for that conclusion, many of which are so clearly incorrect that plaintiffs don't even defend them on appeal, some of which are all but in open defiance of the Supreme Court's decision in Little Sisters, and all of which are inconsistent with the deferential standard of review required by the Administrative Procedure Act. This court should accordingly reverse. Now, there are a lot of issues in the case. Happy to take them in whatever order would be most helpful to the court. To my mind, the central question is whether the departments reasonably decided to extend the religious exemption to all employers who have religious objections to the mandate. And I'd like to set the table, if I could, just by putting employers who object to the mandate in 3 distinct categories, because I think the analysis differs somewhat as to each, and it's just helpful to keep straight what we're talking about with so many different issues in the case. So category 1, and I think category 1 is really the heartland of the rule, is employers who also object to the accommodation, not just to the mandate, but also to the accommodation. Category 2 would be employers who don't object to the accommodation and will voluntarily use it. Category 3, and I'm not sure there are actually any real-world employers who fall in category 3, but it's at least conceptually a possible category, would be employers who don't object to the mandate, but nonetheless will decline to use the mandate, or will decline to use the accommodation, sorry. Don't object to the accommodation, but will decline to use the accommodation. It's really, I think, categories 2 and 3 that was the focus of the district court's analysis here, at least the first couple of points the district court made, where the court concluded that there was a mismatch, the court said, between the justifications that departments offered in the rule and the scope of the rule, because the court was concerned about extending the exemption to those employers who don't have an objection to the accommodation. The key flaw in that analysis is it rests on a basic misunderstanding of what the departments set out to do in this rule. It rests on the mistaken notion that their sole objective was to do the bare minimum necessary to satisfy RFRA, that they were focused solely on resolving the continuing objections of those employers who object to the accommodation. That is simply not what the departments set out to do here. The departments instead decided to set everything aside and take a fresh look at everything. And they decided, as a policy matter, exercising their authority under both the Affordable Care Act and also under RFRA, that an exemption was the most appropriate administrative response in the face of the various religious objections that had been raised to both the mandate and to the accommodation. So the departments could hardly have been clearer. This is in sections 2B and 2C1 of the rule, that they adopted the exemption as a policy matter, as the most appropriate administrative response, as they said, even if RFRA does not compel it.
At the same time, when it goes on to talk about what that means, it references rules being necessary to ensure the protection of sincerely held religious beliefs. It says, in light of RFRA, the expanded exemption was considered appropriate, and the broader exemption being an appropriate response to a statute that imposes a substantial burden on the exercise of religion under RFRA. Doesn't each of those make clear that it is actually the concern of violating RFRA that's driving these the new final rule?
So I think it's fair to say that RFRA at various points enters into the department's analysis here, but I don't think it was driving all of their analysis. And the department's invoked two sources of authority that are independent of whether RFRA requires an exemption. One of them is independent of RFRA altogether, and the second, while related to RFRA, is independent of the question whether RFRA requires an exemption. So start with the first one. The first one is their authority under the Affordable Care Act itself. So for purposes of this analysis, you could just pretend there is no such statute as RFRA. What the Supreme Court held in Little Sisters is that the departments have statutory authority under the Affordable Care Act to create a religious exemption for those parties who have an objection to the mandate. And the departments exercise that authority here, in particular in Section 2B of the rule. So that's wholly independent of RFRA. The second box, which is related to RFRA but independent of whether RFRA requires an exemption, is discussed in Part 2C1 of the rule. And here we start with the premise of what the Supreme Court held in Hobby Lobby, which is that the mandate imposes a substantial burden on those employers who object to it within the meaning of RFRA. Taking that as a premise, the department said, okay, RFRA tells us we can't impose that substantial burden, but it does not prescribe the remedy. It doesn't tell us how to eliminate the substantial burden. So for purposes of this analysis, you could assume, obviously it's not our position, but you could assume that the accommodation is one permissible way consistent with RFRA that they could eliminate the substantial burden. Where would that leave the departments? They would then face a choice. They would have two ways they could eliminate the substantial burden. One would be by adopting an exemption, and one would be by adopting an accommodation. And they said, as a policy matter, between those two choices, we think the appropriate administrative response, reevaluating everything and taking a fresh look at everything, is to adopt an exemption as a discretionary matter under RFRA to eliminate the substantial burden. It's only then when they get to Part 2C2 of the analysis that they start talking about what RFRA actually requires as a response to the substantial burden. And they say, for those employers who object to both the mandate and the accommodation, RFRA requires an exemption. So there is no mismatch between the department's proffered justification and the scope of the rule. And I don't even think that the plaintiffs here dispute that if you understand the rule that way that we do, that they were taking a fresh look at all of this and exercising policy discretion, that there is any sort of mismatch or any internal inconsistency between the state of justification and the scope of the rule. There's a related, but I think slightly different strand of argument here that focuses on that second and third category of employers who don't object to the accommodation. And that's this idea that including them within the exemption is arbitrary and capricious because it's all cost and no benefit. In fact, I think it's nearly closer to the reverse of that, all benefit and no cost. And that's because, again, if you look at that second category of employers who don't object to the accommodation and will voluntarily use it, there's no cost to women or employees in that situation. The only possible cost is in that third bucket, where you have employers who don't object to the accommodation and decline to use the accommodation. And there's no reason to think that that set is even occupied by any real world employers. I would invite the court to look at page 534 of the joint appendix, where the departments explained a couple of things. They said, number one, compliance with the mandate is cost neutral for the employer. So there's no financial incentive not to use the accommodation if you don't object to it. All you're accomplishing as the employer, if you do that, is depriving your employees of a very valuable benefit that costs you as the employer nothing. So it would be nigh unto irrational for an employer who doesn't object to the accommodation to decline to use it and deprive employees of this valuable benefit. On the other hand, omitting contraceptive coverage, as the department's explained, is costly to an employer. It often leads to severe public criticism, backlash, boycotts, things like that. And so the department said that they expected that entities would be reluctant to use the exemption unless they are committed to their views to a significant degree. That's again at JA 534. So there's no reason to think that by extending the exemption to those employers who don't object to the accommodation, that the department's imposed any real-world cost on employees, on women, in terms of being deprived of access to contraception coverage. On the other hand, there are real-world benefits to doing that, as the department's explained, that gets them out of the business of having to have these intrusive inquiries into religious belief.
That's turned out as a hypothesis as to the dynamics for different employers. One of the concerns of the district court was that there's no longer an ex-ante enforcement mechanism without notice, without certification, that there could be abuse in that third category. Would we consider that change in conjunction with the others? How could it be rational for the agencies to make these modifications where there's no mechanism to evaluate the sincerity of the invocation of the exemption?
There is a mechanism to evaluate the sincerity of the objection. It's simply when it would be done ex post as opposed to ex ante, which is the way that the religious exemption has always worked. It has never required notice up front from the entity that's claiming the exemption.
That, you're talking about a religious organization that's relatively easy to identify, even given tax status. You're talking about exemptions that can be claimed by any company, even publicly traded companies. How would it even come to the department's attention that someone had invoked the exemption?
So as the department's explained in the rule, the plans are required by law to have summaries of benefits that will let employees know whether contraception is covered as part of the plan. And also they are required by law to notify their beneficiaries, employees, of any changes to the benefit profile. So employees will definitely know whether or not the employer is providing contraception coverage. And what the department said is, this is not a change from the way this exemption has operated in the past. It's the same exact mechanisms, for example, that would be used to police fraudulent claims of grandfather status. That's one of the exemptions in the act itself, that the preventive services mandate, including the contraceptive mandate, does not apply to grandfather plans, which at least at one point in time covered tens of millions of employees, and people could fraudulently claim their plan hasn't made changes and is therefore grandfathered. And it's the same mechanisms that would be used to police that. And the department said that they hadn't been aware of any abuse of this doing ex post enforcement for both the religious exemption and the grandfather exemption. And they were unaware of any reason why the threat of sanctions later, the threat of enforcement, ERISA enforcement actions, tax penalties would fail to deter misconduct. So they're looking at that side of the equation. On the other side, they're looking at if we require some ex ante notification, that's at a minimum going to impose additional burdens on both the employer and the government. So they're balancing competing interests here. And under the Administrative Procedure Act, that's where this court's deference has to be at its maximum. Again, the standard is simply, is a rule reasonable and reasonably explained? And the departments reasonably explained their choice to use ex post enforcement to police any claims of insincere objections. And I'd also go back to what I said previously, which is there really isn't any good reason to think there will be insincere objections here. I mean, you can imagine situations where there is an incentive to fraudulently claim a religious belief or a religious exemption. For example, if you're trying to get out of the draft, you might want to say you have a religious objection to military service, even if you don't. There is no good reason here why an employer who doesn't have a sincere objection to providing contraceptive coverage would insincerely claim the exemption when they can use the accommodation, which remains there as an optional alternative, and still provide seamless contraceptive coverage to all of their employees at zero cost to the employer, and avoiding any of the criticism and public backlash that often comes with omitting contraceptive coverage from the plan. So I think considering all of those factors, the departments were more than reasonable and more than reasonably explained their choice to use ex post enforcement, as they always had, to police fraudulent claims of exempt status.
Unless my colleagues have additional questions on that point, could you take a few minutes and talk to us about why it is not arbitrary and capricious to include a category of claims that may be impossible to bring, specifically publicly traded companies?
So I think it's not arbitrary and capricious because the departments recognize that even though in their own judgment it was unlikely that a publicly traded company would ever have a religious objection to the mandate, it was not impossible. It was not something they could rule out. What they said, they said that in a large country comprised of a supermajority of religious persons, some publicly traded entities might claim a religious character for their company. They said, or the majority of shares of some publicly traded companies might be controlled by a small group of religiously devout persons. And they also said that they didn't want to force private companies who have religious objections to the mandate to have to choose between going public and keeping their exemption under the regulations. So they said, and they were upfront about it, their own best estimate was that precisely zero publicly traded companies would claim the exemption. But they said, if there is a company out there that has a sincere religious objection adopted in accordance with the sorts of state laws that govern corporate decision-making, and companies all the time adopt positions, stances on ideological, ethical, political, moral issues, there's no reason in principle they couldn't also invoke a religious objection to contraceptive coverage. And the department said, you know, if that company does exist, we think that under the applicable principles, both as a policy matter and under RFRA, that they should have an exemption, because that would be requiring them to comply with the mandate would be a substantial burden on their religious exercise. Now, the plaintiffs say it's just simply impossible for a publicly traded company to exercise religion within the meaning of RFRA. They have no authority for that position, but if they were right that it's impossible for a publicly traded company to have religious exercise, hold a sincere religious objection, then this would be completely harmless. And I don't see why they would get any relief, but at most it would be an injunction or vacatur of the one line in the rule that includes publicly traded companies within the list of entities that are eligible to claim the exemption. There's no world in which that error would take down the entire rule.
And if that were a concern, would it be severed?
Yes, I think so.
It could be severed. What about the inclusion of a moral exemption? And the explanations provided that that's done in a number of other statutes, it's accompanying concerns about religious exercise. But even if it's not a compelling interest on the other side, there's at least an important interest where RFRA as a consideration is not informing the exemption, and free exercise is not informing that exemption. Doesn't there need to be a separate independent balancing of interests?
I think there does need to be a separate analysis, and I think the agencies did that here. They looked at various factors on one side of the ledger that they concluded favored adopting the moral exemption, including that Congress had often provided parallel moral and religious exemptions in healthcare contexts like this. For example, they looked specifically at one of the then most recent statements by Congress in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2018. Congress had directed that if the District of Columbia was going to adopt a contraceptive mandate, that should include a conscience clause that exempted both religious and moral objectors. So they're looking at what Congress has done, even in this very specific context of a contraceptive mandate, and weighing that in the balance. They're looking more broadly at what state and federal regulators have done in the healthcare context, particularly when we're talking about abortion, which is a hotly contested issue. But many people, even if not religious, have the belief that that's the unjustified taking of a human life and have a sincere, conscientious objection to that. And the departments are choosing to respect that. They also wanted to avoid disparate treatment between religious objections and moral objections, and they were considering the litigation that had been brought in the past by those who have moral objections to the mandate and saying we want to put that litigation, that resource draining litigation, behind us. So that's on one side of the ledger. Then on the other side of the ledger, they said the costs here of adopting a moral exemption are truly minimal, because they expected that the moral exemption would be invoked almost exclusively by nonprofit companies whose employees share the same objection to contraception that the employer has. Things like March for Life, pro-life groups, where the employees aren't going to be using contraception anyway. Outside that category, in the category of for-profit entities that they expected would invoke the moral exemption, they said fewer than 10 companies nationwide, affecting 15 women nationwide. So truly, truly minimal impacts on access to contraception coverage weighed against all of those factors I listed before. And I guess it's something that's vested in the agency's virtually unbridled discretion, as the Supreme Court said. They reasonably weighed and reached the conclusion that they should have a moral exemption as well. And here, I think the district court's analysis in particular, which I don't even take the plaintiffs to defend, is fundamentally at war with Little Sisters, because what the district court said is that moral objections are simply a factor that Congress did not intend the agencies to consider, and therefore it was an impermissible consideration. That's after the Supreme Court held in Little Sisters that there is statutory authority to create a moral exemption. So the district court is really positing a situation where the agency's organic statute authorizes the agency to do something, and then saying the Administrative Procedure Act prohibits the agency from considering doing that thing that the statute authorizes them to do. I think just to state that proposition is to refute it.
Judge Roth, any questions?
I have no.
Okay, I'll pass the lectern to Mr. Reed.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mark Rienzi for the Little Sisters. There are some drastic ways that either the federal government or the courts could resolve a longstanding fight over religious exemptions to the contraceptive mandate. But the federal government didn't choose those. And just so to set up what they are, either this court or the Supreme Court could take the Supreme Court up on its suggestion that maybe there's a non-delegation problem with the underlying mandate. The agencies, of course, have discretion to not have a contraceptive mandate at all. Instead, they chose a middle ground, and their middle ground was that they would accommodate religion, but leave the contraceptive mandate in place for the vast majority of employers, and leave the accommodation in place for employers who were willing to use it, which is a pro-contraception move for the federal government to make. When they did that, they were acting well within the discretion granted to them by Congress, well within the order given to them by Congress under RFRA, well within the Supreme Court's express instructions to the agency about how to deal with this problem. And nothing about that is even close to arbitrary and capricious. Let me start with something that might be surprising in a culture war type case and dispute that's gone on for 15 years. Let me start with a broad area of agreement, agreement across presidential administrations, agreement among most Supreme Court justices who've touched the case, and even agreement among the various government parties in your courtroom today. And that agreement is really over what Mr. MacArthur characterized as the Category 1 cases, the situations where you have an employer who objects to complying with the self-certification accommodation. In other words, employers who are in the Little Sisters category. That's, of course, the Trump administration's position, is that you can exempt them. It was also the Biden administration's position. They both left this rule in place for the entire 4 years. And when they had a proposed rule change, they were going to leave the religious exemption rule entirely in place. Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, who joined her opinion, said at page 708 of the Supreme Court decision that the agencies could have exempted people like the Little Sisters of the Poor. And on page 84 of my friends from the state's brief, page 84 of their brief, they even say that the agency could have exempted anyone who just says, I object to the accommodation, to the self-certification accommodation. That is a massive heartland, and that actually includes all known religious employer cases to date. And these cases have been going on for almost 15 years now. But that's where everyone real and known sits. Pennsylvania's argument and New Jersey's argument rests on finding some potential claims that are at the periphery of that vast heartland of agreement, and that may be entirely hypothetical. I actually think they are entirely hypothetical, and saying that you should zero in on those and sink the entire ship, right? You should take away this entire broad agreement among everybody on all sides and wipe out the exemption for everybody to say the whole thing is arbitrary and capricious. I don't think that's how APA law works. I think you'd have to dramatically change how you do arbitrary and capricious review to do that. But let me just focus on their claims about what's going on at the periphery that lets you sink the whole ship.
Well, that doesn't seem to be their concern or the district court's. It's that if you have that group and it's so very unlikely, in fact, you're positing that these other categories don't exist, that extending the exemption to these other categories is arbitrary and capricious.
So I do agree. That's the way the criticism is framed. One, I don't think they exist. And two, I don't think that's the way the law works. So on the I don't think they exist part, let's start with the odd claim of you have to have an objection to the direct mandate, but you're okay with the accommodation, but you will for some reason go take the religious exemption instead of using the accommodation. I've been litigating these cases for 15 years. No case has ever shown somebody who looks like that. So it's entirely hypothetical.
So how is it rational then to extend the exemption to these categories that, as you would have, don't exist?
So there may well be people who are taking the accommodation under duress, right? People don't love to come into court. Lawyers and judges love court, but not everybody else loves to come to court. So some people may have been under duress. Some people may have felt the pressure. Maybe the government just says, look, under Hobby Lobby, right, we have an obligation under RFRA because the Supreme Court said so, to find some way not to impose the burden on everybody who objects to the mandate. The accommodation might be one permissible choice of a way to do that, but there's certainly nothing that obligates them to keep that in place for everybody. There's nothing under law that makes them have an accommodation. And RFRA does not impose a rule of parsimony that says you must go for the stingiest or the narrowest way of meeting the objection. So they've got this category that the Supreme Court told them they must stop burdening their religion. This is one very rational way to do it and to say it might theoretically be possible, but I don't care. All that said, I frankly disagree with both governments in the room. I actually think the rule doesn't apply quite the way they think. I think they're all ignoring to the extent that language that is in the text of the exemption. It specifically says that you can only be an exempt entity to the extent that you object to either providing or, and so this is on page 82 of our brief, our opening brief, where we were quoting the federal regulations. But the exemption of this paragraph will apply to the extent that one of these entities, based on its sincerely held religious beliefs, objects to establishing or maintaining a plan, coverage, or a plan issuer or third-party administrator that provides or arranges the coverage or payments. So I actually think under the plain language that they adopted, if one of these, you know, super unlikely things happens, I'm not sure they're exempt anyway. The exemption only goes to the extent that you have an objection. And the government talked about that in the Federal Register at page 57558. So that's 83 Fed Reg 57558, column one. They've got a long discussion that to the extent that means that you're only exempt to the extent of your religious objection. So if it's the case that somebody exists in that odd category, I think it'd be pretty easy either for this court or some other court to just say, we take that language seriously and someone is not exempt. But either way, even if it doesn't work that way, even if it's very rare, I don't see how it's arbitrary and capricious if you've got a category the Supreme Court told you you must exempt and you happen to be a hair's breadth broader than that. That can't be arbitrary and capricious review means. If that's what it means, then it's a complete rewrite of the Code of Federal Regulations. It sinks many other regulations. It frankly would sink most of the regulations that have happened in this conflict, right? So the religious employer exemption, at page 55 or 56 of the state's brief, they talk about how under the religious employer exemption, there's actually no requirement to certify anything. In other words, they don't even have to certify that they object to the mandate, that they object to contraception at all, right? The agency has just said, all groups in this category, which is discriminatory because it leaves out the little sisters, but I'll save that for a different argument. But if you're in this category, you're exempt, right? If that violates the APA to include anyone who doesn't have an objection, then this whole thing goes down, right? The whole mandate, the accommodation goes down because it's all built on the same regulations. That's just not how APA law works. And if this court were to write the opinion saying that that's how the APA works, it's really the death warrant for the whole contraceptive mandate system. I think a similar, I'm sorry, Judge.
We don't reach these merits issues if there's not standing. I expected you would start there. Are you no longer pressing that as an objection to this litigation?
No, we certainly don't think Pennsylvania has standing, and I'm happy to discuss that. And I, of course, agree that you don't have to reach any of these issues if you just say Pennsylvania lacks standing. Let me start. I recognize that in 2019, a different panel of this court found that they did have standing based on their predictions about what were supposedly imminent harms. That decision was vacated, but I understand you take it seriously. I would too. But the fact of the matter is we've got now many years of experience to see, well, that imminent harm, was it actually imminent? And I would just suggest to you that the facts suggest it was not and is not imminent at all, and Pennsylvania doesn't have standing. They can't find anybody, any Pennsylvania employer who has terminated coverage in the 5 years this rule was in effect. They don't give you any evidence of that. Any individual woman who's complained about it, no evidence of that. Any budget, right? Like they control their own budgets. Did their budget for contraceptive coverage go up? Did they start spending more for this? I don't know, because they gave you nothing, right? Under Lujan, the plaintiff has an obligation to meet a rising burden of proof to prove their standing at each stage of the case. We're now at summary judgment. And importantly, back in 2019, when this court made guesses about what was imminent, you had to make guesses. The rule hadn't taken effect yet. You didn't know. In 2026, no one needs to guess because the Supreme Court put this rule back in effect for 5 years. And the states just didn't do their homework. They chose not to come forward with any evidence of the first penny of harm to the state of Pennsylvania. And let me just say, that makes perfect sense because there are a lot of ways to get contraception. It makes perfect sense because a lot of the people who we're talking about can get injunctions or protected some other way.
But one of them, and when one that the department is anticipating would be used, are state programs, which would seem to have a fiscal impact.
If in fact the regulation produced people who were losing their insurance coverage, and then those people qualified for those state programs and then showed up at the door, Pennsylvania might have a penny's worth of harm. They don't have any evidence that that's true. I don't know that that's true. And I think the standing argument Pennsylvania is making here, they want you to think about a case like Diamond Alternatives and say, well, this is like when the EPA has a regulation that is designed to depress fuel sales. And then the fuel sellers come in and say, hey, it's hurting. This law is not designed to impact the states. This law is not about the states. This law is about the federal government following the best of our traditions and accommodating religion with its own mandate. Pennsylvania can, of course, go have a contraceptive mandate for employers if they want. They have not, which is odd, but they could. Pennsylvania's claim that they've got standing is much more like the doctors who lost 9-0 in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, where the Supreme Court said, look, if the doctors can come in every time there's a change to health regulation and say, you know what, more people are going to show up at my hospital. I'm going to have to work overtime. I'm going to have to do these things to heal people. That's essentially a limitless grant of standing, and it's inconsistent with Article 3. That's what this case is like, right? Sure, at some level, any state could always come into your courtroom and say anything the federal government did, right? Did they increase spending on this or decrease it on that? Could have some impact on the health of our citizens, and some of them could come to me. That can't be enough to let the states tell the federal courts that you have to stop the federal government from having a religious exemption to its law. So I don't think they have standing. I don't think the fact that the Supreme Court heard the case last time, which is something the state suggests, I don't think that means that they're standing either. Again, at that point, we were still in guesstimate world where the rule hadn't taken effect. The best you could do was guesses about imminent harm. We now know the harm was not imminent. But the Supreme Court just said recently, at least four justices just said in the temporary protected status case, Mullen versus Doe, that where what we're doing is reversing a preliminary injunction, we actually don't need to satisfy ourselves as to standing at all. So I don't think there's much that can be read into the last round on the standing point either. And I'll just say also, in addition to the lack of injury, there are also serious problems with redressability. I really don't think Article III courts who are pledged to uphold the Constitution can just turn a blind eye the way the states want you to and say, it doesn't matter if the underlying mandate is constitutional, it doesn't matter if it can be enforced. Their whole theory of the case depends on religious parties having to bend to the will of the federal government.
But what's your authority for bootstrapping the constitutional claim where there wasn't a cross claim filed?
So one, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is one place where they do it, right? If you look at the court's analysis, they think about, well, what do other conscience protections give these doctors? What does EMTALA give these doctors? The court's discussion under the Article 3 heading of how should we figure out if there's standing and redressability here goes into at length, let's think about how these other laws apply to this situation. We're raising the claim. We've been raising the claim for years now. I don't think it needs to be framed as a cross claim against the party who's not trying to do something to us, right? In other words, I think it would be a little odd for us to have a cross claim against the federal government in this case. The federal government is, to their credit, trying not to impose a burden on our religion. We've raised it as an Article 3 standing and redressability argument, and I do think it's a serious problem that the states have. I see I'm close to out of time. May I just make two more brief points?
Please.
One, the states want to rely on Geneva College and real alternatives. And I think Geneva College was vacated by the Supreme Court and real alternatives discussing some other issue, but I don't think you need to get there because you can just look at the Supreme Court's decision in Little Sisters of the Poor. The Supreme Court knows exactly what it said and what it did, and they say we instructed the agencies that they must accommodate the people who object to the accommodation, right? That's what the Supreme Court said in this case. That's law of the case. The idea that it's then arbitrary and capricious for the federal government to do that doesn't make sense. And last point I would make is 75 years ago in Zorak versus Clausen, the Supreme Court said that religious accommodations are the best of our traditions, and they are. And one of the reasons are is they allow us to reach live and let live solutions without having all or nothing fights that say, well, federal government, if you don't get religious exemptions, you can get rid of the whole mandate. Religious exemptions are doing their job here. They're getting us to a live and let live world where the federal government left the contraceptive mandate in place for those who want it, left the accommodation in place for those who want it, and left the mandate applicable to most parties. This court can stick with the best of those traditions by reversing the district court and honestly ending a fight that has gone on far too long.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Amy Thompson on behalf of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the state of New Jersey. I'd like to first respond to the government's argument that the religious exemption is simply an independent policy justification separated from the RFRA. I think Judge Krause, as you noted, that is inconsistent with the actual language of the religious rule itself, which repeatedly invoked RFRA and a desire to lift the burdens, but they perceived to be burdens, religious objectors, as the single motivating factor for adopting the religious exemption. Now,
I mean, you agree it's possible to consider the interests of, that are addressed by RFRA, and that's distinct from agreeing that RFRA requires that result, right?
I agree that the agencies expressed two justifications for the rule. One was that they were attempting to address religious objections to the mandate, and two, that they felt that RFRA compelled the exemption in some circumstances for religious employers who objected to the accommodation. In both circumstances, we believe that the agency's reasoning was arbitrary and capricious. In the first instance, because they granted an exemption that swept well beyond, as counsel for the interveners just noted, all existing religious employer cases to date. And as the government noted, granted an exemption to even entities that are comfortable with the accommodation. Now the government notes in citing to the interim final rule, not to the final rule, that they believed that employers would not switch if they were satisfied with the accommodation. But in the final rule, the agencies determined that over half of currently accommodated entities would switch to the detriment of the female employees who worked for those employers. So to grant an exemption to entities who have stated no objection or have no to the accommodation or to the status quo is the fundamental mismatch that shows that there is not a rational connection between, as Justice Kagan observed, between the problem the agencies set out to solve and the solution they arrived at. Similarly, with the moral exemption, the agencies state that they are looking to what they believed Congress would have done had Congress either explicitly mandated contraceptive coverage or thought that that would be one of their preventive services covered by the Women's Health Amendment. But again, that rationale is belied by the record. Congress did know. There's numerous statements by senators during consideration of the Affordable Care Act that they did anticipate that contraception would be a preventative service that would fall under the scope of the Women's Health Amendment. Those were both in our brief and in comments, numerous comments that were part of the record given to the agency during the comment process.
We have little sisters here at the Supreme Court telling us that there is virtually unbridled discretion on the part of the department to carve out exemptions. In effect, what the department's done is just change the default. Instead of opting out, you have to opt in. Why isn't that choice where the agency has the authority to exercise virtually unbridled discretion, a rational one?
Because on the other side of the ledger, which is a point that neither the government nor the interveners have mentioned so far this morning, are the women who are guaranteed coverage of preventative services by law under the Women's Health Amendment. Now, in their briefing, the government likes to disclaim the contraceptive mandate as a sub-regulatory ruling, but the contraceptive mandate is a part of guidelines that have been supported by HRSA since 2011, as Congress instructed the agencies to do. The contraceptive mandate cannot be separated from the Women's Health Amendment or from the preventive services that women are guaranteed coverage for by law. So where the agencies are instructed by law and by the Supreme Court in Zubik to balance competing interests, they must actually balance those competing interests. And instead here, as Justice Kagan observed, they enacted a rule that was all cost and no benefit by granting an exemption that swept well beyond all religious employer cases to date that had been brought to the courts.
We're not to second guess policy decisions. We're looking at whether they've articulated a reasonable basis for these choices, and where there's pages and pages of the final rule explaining the department's thinking as they carved out both of these exemptions. Why isn't what you're asking us to do revisiting the policy when we're limited to looking at whether there's been consideration of relevant factors and a sufficient explanation?
I think I have two answers for you, Your Honor. So first, the arbitrary and capricious standard is, while deferential, does require examining whether the agency drew a rational connection between the problem and the solution. I think with the religious exemption, they have conceded that they swept more broad than all existing religious employers to date, to the detriment of women who work for employers. And I should note where the government says that it doesn't expect that a publicly traded company would take advantage of the exemption. We don't actually know. And the Biden administration, when they put out their proposed rule, noted that because there's no notice requirement as part of how the exemptions operate, there is no way to know what employers have claimed either the religious exemption or the moral exemption, whether they actually had a sincere objection to contraception or to the accommodation, or whether they actually experienced a substantial burden. So there is no way to actually know how many women have been potentially impacted and deprived of the contraceptive care guaranteed to them by law. There's the other aspects of arbitrary and capricious rulemaking, failure to consider important aspects of the problem, again, with publicly traded companies. Our position is not that it is impossible that a publicly traded company could exercise religion. It is that the agencies do not get deference in how RFRA is interpreted or enforced. It is both not a statute that they implement, but also under Loper-Bright, the agencies do not get any deference in how they interpret a statute. That is for the courts to do. And no court has found that any publicly traded company can exercise religion. Indeed, in this court's decision in Safe House, where this court expressed skepticism of that, it noted that whether a religious employer could potentially exercise religion would turn on sincerity, which, as you observed, is not possible to be determined here, because the agencies have not created any mechanism for the agency or a court or anyone to assess the sincerity of an employer's objection.
Well, their answer is that it's post hoc, and why aren't those post hoc mechanisms sufficient?
Those post hoc enforcement mechanisms, first, it's not clear how that would happen. It appears that they are expecting female employees of companies to page through the voluminous coverage policies that they get, but then are they supposed to go to court and litigate against their employer on the grounds that they don't believe their employer has a sincere religious objection to the contraceptive coverage or the accommodation? That is an incredible burden to place on employees and on women who, again, by law are supposed to be guaranteed contraceptive coverage under the Women's Health Amendment. And it's also just never how RFRA has operated, and where the agencies are looking throughout the language of their people to RFRA for guidance for how they are interpreting this, because they are, as they've talked about extensively, responding to litigation brought under RFRA. RFRA has never permitted post hoc enforcement of an exemption to generally applicable law. It is the fact duty under the precedent of this court for alternatives for courts as to examine whether a substantial burden exists as a question of fact and as a question of law. That is part of how it operates. To put a burden instead on women afterwards misunderstands what Congress directed them to do under the Women's Health Amendment.
Isn't that just a continuation of the prior policy, for example, that applied to religious organizations?
Religious organizations exemption was tied specifically to their tax status, which is a status that is enforced in the tax code for other reasons as well. And I'll note that in granting that exemption for churches, it used to be more strenuous. The church or auxiliary had to demonstrate additional factors in terms of how they operated in order to claim that exemption. The agency subsequently simplified it. So it is solely based on the tax status of the entity, as is common throughout much of our case law, where certain exemptions are granted to entities based on their tax status. When it comes to knowing whether a publicly traded company's board of directors or executives have collectively decided that the corporate entity has a religious exercise, and then that religious exercise has been substantially burdened by the concept of mandate or by the accommodation, that is not, that is far afield from simply looking at whether the entity has claimed status as a church for purposes of the tax code. My other answer to your honor's question, though, about the deferential review here is not simply that arbitrary and capricious rulemaking is substantial, but in several ways that this court is not required to defer to the agencies, what the agencies have said. First, in how they have applied RFRA, so where they have concluded that RFRA compels the rule, this court is not obligated to defer to how the agencies interpreted RFRA. And in fact, this court has already held in Geneva College that the accommodation does not impose a substantial burden as a question, as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. That opinion was vacated. It was reaffirmed the principal and real alternatives. But even if this court were to find that that footnote is not precedential, the reasoning certainly remains persuasive and has never been attacked or addressed by the Supreme Court. And then the second way where I would say that the court is not required to defer to the agencies and is how they assess the safety and efficacy and benefits of contraception. Throughout that part of the rule, which the agencies used to undermine a compelling interest in the mandate, the agencies purport to lift up comments that express doubt about whether contraception is safe, whether it's efficacious, whether the concept of mandate has worked at all. I will note as an aside, the record shows that there were maybe a handful of comments, I think less than five, that raised any type of objection or any type of citation to studies that purported to have any of these concerns. But putting that aside, the agencies then declined to take a position repeatedly on scientific questions, on empirical questions. So they did not demonstrate expertise. And this court is not required to defer to agency expertise where the agency has not demonstrated any expertise. Instead, they use this manufactured controversy around the safety and efficacy of contraception to undermine their compelling interest for purposes of RFRA. And that analysis is not entitled to deference. I'd like to return to the point about publicly traded companies for a moment. On top of the fact that another reason why the inclusion of those companies was arbitrary and capricious is that they actually reached the opposite conclusion when looking at the same evidence for purposes of the moral exemption. In both cases, the agencies asked for comments about any potentially publicly traded company who would be interested or who would have a substantial, would assert a substantial burden from the mandate or from the accommodation. They received no comments indicating that any existed, either that any existed with religious objections or that any existed with moral objections. They reached the opposite conclusion about those same facts. In the religious rule, they chose to nonetheless extend a religious exemption to publicly traded companies. But in the moral exemption, they decided that that lack of evidence meant that they should not extend it to publicly traded companies. That disparate treatment of the same facts is additional evidence as to why the extending the religious rule to publicly traded companies is arbitrary and capricious. And they also did not consider how that would operate in practice. The Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby, when it spoke to the availability of state corporate law to permit closely held corporation to determine what its religious beliefs would be for purposes of RFRA, was speaking only about closely held corporations. It actually specifically said that with publicly traded companies, that numerous practical restraints would likely prevent a publicly traded company from ever being able to exercise religion.
Right, but unlikely is not, impossible.
Certainly not impossible, but where the agencies, they simply refer back to that in analysis and would actually address the distinct circumstance of publicly traded companies and how they would be able to possibly determine what an exercise of religion would be, as you pointed out in our brief, it isn't clear whether that is who in the corporate leadership would determine whether a religious belief exists, would it change, people who own stock in the company, would it be the board of directors, et cetera. Those questions were simply not addressed by the court.
And they pointed to state law and around corporate governance, just as the Supreme Court did. How is effectively parroting the Supreme Court as to that issue arbitrary and capricious?
So no state law that we are aware of addresses how a publicly traded company can adopt and document its religious views. And to point to the Supreme Court's analysis that was limited to closely traded companies or closely held companies, without acknowledging that the Supreme Court said it was very unlikely that there'd be many problems with extending it to publicly traded companies, shows that you can't simply map on that analysis. The Supreme Court expressed concerns in Hobby Lobby about publicly traded companies, and yet the agency simply said that the same analysis would apply to publicly traded companies. That is the source of the mismatch.
Just a brief question on this standing point. I understand Little Sisters to be saying that Pennsylvania needs sort of new affidavit that summary judgment. And in your brief, I think you're pointing us to the affidavits that were submitted in 2018 and 2019 that were sort of predictive. What's the sort of best authority that those predictive affidavits continue to suffice at this stage?
So the standing is based on the time that the party filed suit. The only thing that changes from the PI stage or from a motion to dismiss stage to a summary judgment stage is the manner and degree of evidence required. That's in Lohan. But as Hartnett illustrated, the Third Circuit decision in Hartnett, standing is determined on the date that the party files the suit. And the record evidence of harm shows that, one, there are entities in Pennsylvania and New Jersey who will claim the exemption. There are spreadsheets of entities who had litigated against the mandate or the accommodation, or who had sought the accommodation. That's at Joint Appendix 1423 to 56. And that include numerous entities based in Pennsylvania with hundreds of employees. To say nothing of Hobby Lobby, which has many stores in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. There's also the Gruberg Declaration, which is at Joint Appendix 1850 to 1877, which has records of six Pennsylvania employers that requested the religious accommodation. And again, the agencies, it predicted that half of the currently accommodated employers would switch over to the exemption. So we have evidence that entities in Pennsylvania are likely to claim the exemption. We have the evidence from the agencies themselves who acknowledge that upwards of at least 126,000 women will lose coverage because of these exemptions. That is likely an undercount, as illustrated by the Americans United for Separation of Church and State amicus brief that discusses that at pages 16 and 17. But that estimate also assumed that no new women would ever come work for any of these employers. It was a static snapshot of employees that existed at that time. Even there, on the agency's own record, upwards of 126,000 women would lose coverage. And then we have the declarations from Pennsylvania and New Jersey officials that have not been disputed at any point in this litigation, that women will either turn to publicly traded, publicly funded programs for contraception, or will forgo contraception, and which will lead to unintended pregnancies, half of which are publicly funded. I'll point directly to the Allen's Declaration at Joint Appendix 1799, which discusses the Pennsylvania Family Planning Services Program, which provides family planning services for people up to 215% of the poverty limit, where the employer does not cover family planning. So Pennsylvania has specific programs that would apply in this circumstance. So all of this record evidence shows that that the rules will have an impact on state coffers. And that was more than sufficient for a panel of this court in Pennsylvania versus President United States in 2019 to find that Pennsylvania and New Jersey had standing. And indeed, That court rejected the argument by interveners and then by the government as well, I believe, that Pennsylvania had to identify a specific woman, saying that standing as a matter of law does not require that amount of precision. Briefly, Your Honor, I'll touch on the redressability points that were raised by counsel for the interveners. I will note in the panel decision by this court granting intervention, which I believe Judge Roth, you were a part of, the interveners were permitted to intervene to seek the same relief as the government. The government here is the only entity that could potentially be enjoined from enforcing the mandate. The Little Sisters have not cross-claimed against the government, and to attack any of the constitutionality of the mandate would exceed the scope of their intervention. It is also well beyond the claims that the actual plaintiffs, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, have brought here.
Can you speak to the explanation for the moral exemption and where we've got the Supreme Court speaking in plural terms about exemptions throughout their opinion, and saying explicitly that there is the unbridled discretion to both of those exemptions. What's the best argument for the inclusion of the moral exemption itself being arbitrary and capricious?
Sure. So I understand that the Supreme Court's language says they have authority to issue the moral rule. Our argument that it is unreasoned is based on the rationale that the agencies themselves offered, which is where the court must look in conducting an arbitrary and capricious analysis. First, the agencies determined that if Congress had included contraception or had known that contraception would have been covered, then they likely would have included a conscious exemption consistent with other statutes that have granted a moral exemption. But Congress, as indicated, did know that contraception was likely to be covered as a preventive service, but chose not to add a moral exemption. So the existence of other moral exemptions in other statutes only shows that Congress made an intentional choice here not to include one. So that reasoning that they used is what is itself arbitrary and capricious. Likewise, in terms of looking to litigation, the agencies identified only two cases brought by employers that had a moral objection to contraception, to the contraceptive mandate. All other ones were based on HFRA. Of those two lawsuits, one ended in a permanent injunction in the District Court of TC, and the other one was rejected by this court in Real Alternatives for failing to bring an equal protection challenge. Those are the only two employers that the agencies had identified in years of litigation. And they had been definitively resolved. One entity was permanently protected from ever having to comply with the mandate, and one, as a matter of law, did not have an actionable claim. In that context, to grant a moral exemption, it does not comport with with the possibility that many, many other entities out there would be seeking a moral exemption. And true, the agencies did acknowledge that they did not think many entities would claim it, but they also set up no notice requirement, no ability to determine whether an entity has claimed it. And they also set up no mechanism to determine whether that employer has a moral conviction consistent with its test in Welsh, which is what they said was the standard. The Welsh test involves a conviction that an individual deeply and sincerely holds, purely ethical and moral in source, that imposes a duty and occupies a place in life parallel to that filled by God for a person in a religious, who is religious. There's no mechanism to determine whether an employer claiming the moral exemption satisfies that standard that they put into their own rule as being the test. So I think those two points show that the problem that they set out to solve didn't exist, and the reason they said they needed to solve it was not supported by the congressional record.
questions.
If the court has no further questions.
Judge Roth?
No questions.
Thank you. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
I have just a few points. I want to start out with a couple that go to the purported mismatch. Ms. Thompson cited some numbers from the final rule about the projections of how many previously accommodated entities would switch over to using the exemption. I think she's misunderstanding those numbers, at least to the extent that she is suggesting that those who switch over are entities who have no objection to the accommodation. That is not the case. That is not what these numbers speak to, because there are lots of reasons why employers may have previously used the accommodation, even though they objected to it. And now that they're entitled to the exemption, they will switch to the exemption. The agencies didn't make a numerical estimate of what I've characterized as category three, those entities hypothetically who don't object to the accommodation, but nonetheless will decline to use it. Instead, they described qualitatively why they thought that was unlikely to happen, the sorts of reasons that I outlined previously, and that was certainly a rational analysis. Judge Krause, I want to address on your question of how could it be?
Before you get there, though, does the committee have a position on standing?
No, we do not. We have not taken a position. We obviously raised that issue in the first appeal. We lost. We've accepted our loss and moved on. So we haven't taken a position on that. I wanted to address, Judge Krause, your question about how could it be rational to extend the exemption to categories of people that we don't think exist. The first point is, category two emphatically does exist, the employers who don't object to the accommodation and will voluntarily use it. And that is very important. The departments said that almost half of the previously accommodated entities, accounting for like 75% of the employees covered by previously accommodated plans, would continue to use the accommodation. And that obviously achieves the very important government interest of allowing the employees of those employers to continue to receive seamless contraceptive coverage through their employers' health plans, while at the same time honoring their objection to the mandate. So that is an important interest. Category three, the one that we think hypothetically likely doesn't even exist. I started to talk about before what I think the benefits of that. I didn't finish my answer, so I want to be clear about that. The benefits are twofold, one about workability and one about avoiding disparate treatment of similarly situated religious employers. So the first one on workability, it takes off the table the question of the sincerity of an objection to the accommodation. The government no longer has to inquire into that. And the Supreme Court has long recognized that avoiding those sorts of intrusive inquiries where the government gets entangled with religious belief is itself an important interest. Cases like Amos versus Presiding Bishopric. So it avoids that, takes that inquiry off the table. The other point is it avoids disparate treatment, because there are certain employers who have religious objections that the departments by law cannot force to use the accommodation, namely employers who have self-insured church plans, and that covers a lot of religiously affiliated employers. The departments simply lack authority under ERISA to require use of the accommodation, so they are effectively exempt. And so the departments decided, we want all religious employers to be treated equally in this respect. Again, that was their judgment to make, exercising their virtually unbridled policy discretion. And when the cost on the other side of the scale is completely a hypothetical, speculative one that the departments think is likely zero, that is a rational calculus. But even if you were to think that that were arbitrary and capricious, there is still, that's not the end of the analysis here. They would have to show prejudice. It's their burden to show prejudice. They haven't even attempted to carry that burden. They haven't shown any employer who, in the 5 years that this rule was in effect before it was vacated by the district court, fits category three. And they haven't given any even explanation qualitatively why any employer who doesn't object to the accommodation would nonetheless decline to use it. So they haven't met their burden to show prejudice. And even if you thought they had, there still would be a question of remedy. And there's no way that that flaw, if there is a flaw that goes to these hypothetical, speculative, marginal applications of the rule, would take down the entire rule. At most, you would have a focused remedy on that specific issue.
Given that the department has kept in place the mechanics for requesting an accommodation, what should we make of the rationale put forward that this would assist with workability, with administrability.
So I think the workability point is the one I mentioned earlier that avoids the inquiry into whether the employer actually has a sincere objection to the accommodation. That's no longer going to be a relevant part of the analysis. And it avoids that that entanglement with religious groups that the Supreme Court has said is an important interest.
But otherwise, the accommodation itself as an alternative remains in place. So in terms of the any other burdens on the department, was it simply the inquiry into sincerity?
For the Category 3 employees, I think so. For the Category 2 employees, and the Category 1 employees, I think the one is the heartland of the rule, and the major workability concern there is that that had led to all of this contentious litigation over what RFRA actually requires. And so as a policy matter, they just said one of the reasons they advanced about why we want to grant exemptions, even if they're not required by RFRA, is to put that resource draining litigation behind us. And that is certainly a rational reason that was within the scope of their discretion under the Affordable Care Act to do.
Okay. Judge Roth, further questions?
No, no questions, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank counsel. Excellent briefing and argument, as well as the many amici who have weighed in on this important case. And just input and perspectives we greatly appreciate. We will take this case under advisement.